Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Milan KG2C will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during the technical net. We also publish technical participants to ponder at starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeated signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only. If they have questions or comments for this net, please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Malen KG2C will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experience to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know here or use our email address, tech@ac2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Milan KG2C. Good evening, Milan.
Good evening, Roy. This is Kilo Golf 2 Charlie. Happy to be here and looking forward to tonight's net. I hope we get a lot of interesting questions. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
As do I, Milan. So let it all begin. Anyone wishing to have any questions or comments for the technical net tonight, please give me your call sign and your name. Very good, Mitch. We will put you on the list. By the way, you have a problem with the sensing, don't you? So that means that the stream is going to shut out when you talk? Okay, it's going to make a problem for us with the archive, but okay, we'll put you on the list. Anyone else tonight?
Yo, Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, question.
Recognized. Anyone else with a question tonight?
To Japan Victor X-ray with a question.
I'd recognize anyone else with a question tonight. Very well, so we'll get to the top of the list. Mitch, N2RGA, what I kind of know what your question is, but please state your question for the audience.
Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
The way I would do it, at least, if I was in your situation, I understand you use a separate receive antenna for the stream different than the one used for transmitting. Now, since the stream is always on the same frequency from the same repeater that's stationary, you only really need to receive from that direction, and you what you really want to do is reject the signal that's dissensing your radio. So I'll try to build a cheap Yagi antenna out of wire. You know, there's plans online for stuff like that. I think the cheapest one I saw is a guy, ZZ, was his call sign. ZZ's Workshop, I think, is his website. And he built it, if I remember correctly, out of coat hangers. You know, wire coat hangers. So you could build, like, I don't know, a 2-3 element Yagi. That would provide you some rejection to the side and will give you gain from the repeater. So that might be enough to solve your dissense problem without having to spend money or move your antennas about. The other thing, I'm sure it's obvious to you, is to move them farther apart. But since you're asking, I'm sure this is not practical. So that's why I'm suggesting, you know, to get more directional gain to the receive antenna to the repeater and to try to reject your other antenna that I assume is somewhere on the side of this one. Can we go to Charlie back tonight?
Thank you very much, Milan. Mitch, would you be interested in trying a little experiment tonight? Well, yeah, let's try the lowest power. I don't know exactly how your power levels are set in the radio that you're using, but let's try the lowest one, and we'll try and figure out how much quieting we hear, and you can look at the needle on the other receiver and see if it's desensing. Give you a signal? Okay, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Is that enough? I'm not listening to the stream. I'm listening to the radio right now. That's the lowest power setting on your transmitter? Hoping that it might be a more granular control, because I had the exact same problem here. There's one week that if you listen very closely to the archive recordings, it was very noisy, and at first I didn't quite realize what was going on because I had thought I was set, I had things set the same exact way, but it tweaked up the power output a little bit too much and desensed my ICOM 7100. And all I had to do was drop the RF power down a little bit. I think I dropped it something like 1 or 2 decibels. And the desensing went away. It's a function of how close the antennas are. But if that's the lowest power setting that you can get, then that's the lowest power setting that you can get. You're only left with other options being a more directional antenna, as Milan mentioned, or repositioning it so that it's farther away and the radiation drops at 1/r². Those are the only two ways, unless you get a better radio that is more insensitive to desensing.
Thank you.
Yes, Malin, comment away.
Wanted to clarify what that website I mentioned. So the title is ZZ's Workbench. And he has a bunch of projects on there. And the specific project I'm talking about is a video that he actually posted on YouTube. So you can go and watch it, where he calls it the $4 ham radio satellite antenna is one of them. He also built one where it was just for 2 meters, I believe. Just made out of coat hangers, basically. So you can just grab a piece of wood, some screws and washers or bolts and nuts if you like to go that way, and straighten up some coat hanger and cut it into the pieces you need for the elements, and you just screw it onto the wood, and one of the elements you will need to connect to the coax, basically. I think he used the gamma match, if I remember correctly, in the project. And it's the cheapest thing imaginable, really. Oh, yeah, it's called the 2-meter coat hanger Yagi antenna, is that project. So it's very easy to build, and I know, you might find it useful anyway, where others might find it useful. He's a very thrifty guy, is what I can say about his stuff, but it's easy to build stuff, and it happens to work. Kill golf to Charlie Beckton.
Very good. Thank you, Malin. Also, Mitch, I have another suggestion. If you have the spare parts and want to experiment, if you have some RG58, a nice length of it, you might want to try it as an attenuator on your transmitter, because you're sending with your full quieting. So probably if you drop the power by another 3 decibels, it would still be a very usable signal. And you might just dip below the point where that other radio gets desensed. So if you have a bit of a length of coax, preferably something lossier like RG58, you might want to consider just playing around with that. Mitch, I wish you luck, and I guess I'll put a little precautionary tale when I load up this archive. Does anyone else have any possible suggestions for Mitch on this?
Question on his question, though, K2JVX.
Is that Lloyd? You broke off at the beginning.
I have a question for Mitch, and this is probably the wrong forum, but he was floated that email about buying the LMR-400 in bulk. Did that ever happen? I'll email you. Sorry for taking up the next time.
Oh, it's quite all right, Lloyd. You know, there's lots of coax. So a lot of it is good. I don't know if anyone's been following the story of how my fan dipole, the coaxial cable, which is LMR-400, just suddenly became useless. I have a time domain reflectometer that tells me if there are impedance mismatches. And originally, when I put it all up, I tested it, and it was a beautiful 50 ohms all the way to the antenna. And then somewhere along the winter, it just auto-destroyed itself, and it didn't have the same impedance for more than a foot or two. So so I'm going to be putting up another fan dipole. This time I'm taking no chances. I'm going to use direct burial LMR 40. It has an extra thick shield on it and such to protect it. You know, it's designed so that you could bury it in the mud and it won't decay. So hopefully I'll have better luck that time.
I saw that all LMR 400, at least from reputable sources that meet the specs, is rated for direct burial. I know the one I have is from DX Engineering, and I remember it was certainly rated for direct burial. Is the one you're getting any different than that, or that's just something that happens to also meet the specs?
No, LMR 400 is not designed for direct burial. This is a specific modification from the maker of LMR products that are specifically designed for direct burial. The DX Engineering probably is designed closer to the specs of LMR 400 DB for direct burial than the standard LMR 400. But the standard LMR 400 isn't really designed to be buried.
The website for DX Engineering and the DXC 400 Max, they do say UV resistant. Yes, direct burial, yes as well. So theirs at least is apparently rated for it. And that's the only kind I bought. I know LMR 400, yes, it's a trademark of Times Microwave, but I thought the original also is rated for direct burial.
No, apparently not. Not from the people who manufacture the stuff. I looked around to see if it was overkill or not, and I got the sense from some people that distribute it that they have been very successful with it, and so I decided I think it's a big 9 cents more per foot. So I figured I use belt and suspenders this time.
There's nothing wrong with belt and suspenders. I mean, I use it. I don't love it, to be honest, but I haven't actually had those problems that you had outdoors with it. The reason I don't like it is, well, it's designed not to be very flexible. I like a coax that's a little bit more flexible, so I personally like the RG213 more. I know it's lossier, so my longer run to the antenna is LMR 400, but then here for my patch cables and through the wall stuff that does get bent more, I use RG213. It has a smaller bend radius and it's much easier to work with because it's a similar diameter on the outside, but it is a stranded center conductor, whereas the DX Engineer LMR 400 Max, it's just a solid conductor.
C2GS. Yeah, I use LMR Flex as jumper cables inside the shack if I'm operating at kilowatts and such. If I'm operating at low power, I tone it down to something like LMR 240, which doesn't need to be special flex version. It's flexible enough. So I don't know. I'm going to give it a try again because it didn't really cost that much difference, and it'll give me a little peace of mind this time. Because, I don't know, all the other LMR 400, knock on wood, is working great. That particular coax defies, I really, when I get it down, I'm going to have to slit it open and see if a family of squirrels are living in it or something.
Anybody who have my question?
We beat that. So, let's go on to Gene. Gene, what's your question for tonight?
Getting back to your cable question, if you go for direct burial cable, does it also have UV protection on it? I'm just curious.
Yes, thankfully it does. Otherwise, people would only use it for direct burial. So what it basically they did was reinforce the layer, the insulation, so that it took more abrasive damage without having any problems. And it's a little bit more resistant to rodents chewing on it and other such things. But it is also UV protective because If it wasn't, then you'd have to make sure every bit of it got buried, which most people have some length of that that's not buried.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Okay, my main question was, today I just jumped on to the website. Do we have an actual website, kc2rc.com, or the Kings County Radio Club?
Works for both. You can type in kc2rc.com and go to the website, or you can type in kingscountyradioclub.com. Both domains are pointed directly at that web host.
That's our favorite, but today on my iPhone, I punched in KC2RC for the technical puzzle. It came off a page, this connection is not private. This website may be impersonating KC2RC.com to steal your personal or financial information. You should close this page.
Comment.
Yes, Milan.
You're using the Chrome web browser, I'm assuming. The thing with Chrome is, because of Google, they decided a while back that everything that's not HTTPS is not to be trusted. And by default, when you just type kc2rc.com, it goes to http://kc2rc.com, which then tries to forward you to kingscountyradioclub.com. And since you're it's a non-trusted domain named that way, it's no good for it. However, if you manually type https://kc2rc.com, you will not have that problem, because that would be HTTPS, and then it would forward you to HTTPS, and there will be no complaints from it. So you can type that manually, or I'm not sure, maybe Roy can change his forwarding to somehow forward. Well, I'm not sure he would be able to. I think Google will warn you regardless. When you type it like that. Or maybe, you know, there's a way for Roy to change the domain to default to the HTTPS, not to the HTTP. I'm not sure. Because I myself, when I hosted my websites, was years ago when I didn't have to worry about HTTPS and HTTP and things like that. So just without security, mostly. All right, back to Ned from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Okay, very good. Right now, Roy is not twiddling with the aliases these days. He has turned it over to our webmaster, Mitch. Mitch, do you have anything to say on this subject? Okay, very good. So hopefully Mitch will do his magic and there won't be a problem anymore. So Gene, you want to tell us your initial question?
That was an initial question, the KRC2.com trying to get the web page.
Okay, I was assuming it was a more technical question. So, nothing else tonight?
Not much, just hanging out, supporting the net.
Okay, very well, Gene. Lloyd, you're up next. What's your question for tonight?
A2JVX. I actually have two questions. One question I think is good for K Kilo Golf to Charlie about satellite contacts. And my question is, I've been getting into it, and I know that he was as well. It's very confusing. How do you enter the fray? I guess that's my question. You don't know who's calling. You don't know who's calling CQ or who's answering. That's what's most confusing. Can you shed some light on that?
Certainly. It is a little messy. I will give it that. I'm assuming your experience was on the FM satellites. The obvious problem there is on FM you have only one frequency to work with, and everyone is on that frequency, and it's very crowded. Here on the East Coast it's very crowded. Actually, from what I've read, if you're on the West Coast, it's not that crowded, not nearly that crowded. So there's a lot of people working, a lot of people. You will notice some regulars, and you will notice them because they tend to have very nice base stations, and actually club stations, some of them, where the club has a satellite station with computer-controlled Yagis that just track and follow the satellite automatically on every pass, so the guy doesn't have to worry about anything other than key his radio and talk. So that's very convenient, and those people tend to always make a lot of contacts. You will keep hearing their call signs over and over. But the way I prepare for it is I have two radios, and each of them is connected to a different portion of the antenna. So one is for 2 meters, the other is for 70 centimeters. On my receive radio, I have headphones to listen, and I have a recorder inline. So the antenna is connected to the radio, from which there's an audio cable to my recorder, from which there are, from which I connect my headphones. So the recorder is inline, so everything I hear is also being recorded. Now, by working full duplex the satellite, whenever I transmit, I can hear whether I'm making it into the satellite or I'm not making it. This is very useful. I recommend you do it that way, with either a full duplex radio or with two radios, see each of them for each band. And how do you understand what's going on? Well, I listen. When I hear the satellite, I don't start yelling out my call sign right away, although you will hear people do that. I listen to trying to get an understanding of who's working who and who's there. And I have a notepad with me, and I write down some call signs and some grid squares. So I kind of have a clue what's going on. But because I have the recording, everything I hear, I know is being recorded. So I don't have to worry about perfectly memorizing the call sign or the grid. I just try to work people and, you know, depend on other people memorizing my call sign for now. And they probably also have recordings, actually. Many people doing satellite stuff to record their conversations automatically. So that's how I manage to do it. I'm not nearly as good as I should be at remembering people's call signs, but I think with more practice, as the weather warms up, I should get better. I hope that answers your question. Back to you. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Kilo 2 Japan Victor X-Ray. Thank you, Milan. But so the thing is, you know, you're just supposed to call out your call sign like you're calling into a repeater, K2JVX. But it's not clear whether when someone answers, whether they're coming back to you or they're answering to someone else or they're just calling CQ. That's where I'm most confused.
Okay, well, there is basically an exchange that's supposed to happen, and most websites that give help on the subject explain it. So let's say I call CQ. Someone's supposed to, you know, the proper response to my CQ is for someone to say my call sign and then his call sign followed by his grid. Then I should answer with his call sign and my call sign followed by my grid. And then he should wish me 7-3 and I should wish him 7-3. It's the proper exchange, and actually you're familiar with that exchange because it's the same on GD65 and ST8. It's the exact same exchange. Unfortunately, as you know, in practice, it doesn't always work out that easily. So that's why I listen first, I write down some call signs, and I figure who has a good signal that I will probably be able to make a contact with him. And that can guarantee me a few contacts. Now, I'm not going to set any distance records with that, but, you know, at least whenever I go on the satellite, I have a good chance of, you know, knowing who to call. So I found it pretty easy to be able to memorize a few call signs and just call out their call sign and my call sign, even if I hear them in conversation. So you don't have to wait for the CQ necessarily if you've heard them talking. But, yeah, if you call CQ, they're supposed to come back with your call sign to indicate that they're calling you and not someone else. And if they don't follow protocol, it will be confusing, and there's really not much you can do other than use your intuition and hope for the best. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to you.
Thank you, Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, Kilo 2 Japan Victor X-Ray. So, Net Control, I have two other brief questions.
Okay, let her rip.
First question is, are you aware of a resource? And I've checked, and it's difficult to find. It concerns grounding, and I'm interested in the geotechnical aspects of grounding, and specifically, most grounding contemplates soil or some form of soil, like sand or whatever. But it's very difficult to find any literature concerning driving a ground rod into solid rock that is immediately below like 6 inches of dirt, where you basically need to put it. And I'd like to know what the resistance and or impedance factors are with respect to like limestone versus sandstone versus shale versus slate, you know, so on and so forth. and I have not been able to find anything about that. The ARRL grounding book doesn't really cover that in detail. It doesn't even have a chart, I don't think. So that's question one, and I guess I'll wait for question two. Back to Ned.
C2GS. Well, an interesting question. I think the reason why it's not particularly addressed by amateurs is because amateurs are kind of stuck with whatever is below their soil. Depending upon where they're located, some grounds are clay, others are different minerals, and you can't really choose which mineral, so you just try and make a deep, good contact with a copper rod, and you hope for the best. None of these things are kind of written in, you know, on the Ten Commandments sort of things. It's not that much of a science. It's more, unfortunately, of an art, and you're not going to find, I don't think, any kind of specific numbers, because usually stones aren't perfect either. There's cracks in them. There's water seeping into them that changes their resistance. There's a lot of things that complicate any real grounding situation. So I don't think too many people have spent too much time measuring the resistances, but I'm sure someone out there must have. It's just, it got lost among all the other bits and pieces of information.
That's basically my appreciation of it, but apparently there, you can, you know, there's certain patterns, maybe more ground rods, less ground rods, I mean, one or two ground rods, and then of course there's the issue of, you know, grounding voltage, and then grounding stray, you know, RF, which is also different. But I wish there was some kind, like, you know, like if you go to the NOAA Space Weather website, which is really excellent, it has lots of good stuff and explanations, and you can track every aspect of the ionosphere there. It's really neat. I was hoping that maybe there'd be some, you know, source for this, but, you know, maybe the fact that you're right, that we're amateurs, it's sort of like discussing drugs with doctors, you know, if we really don't really know what we're doing, and maybe it's best left to a more scientific approach and a licensed electrician. Back to Ned.
And I've heard the licensed electricians, because every so often licensed electricians and amateur radio operators overlap, and they bring their own technical bias to the table as well. There are pluses and there are minuses to bonded multiple grounds. If done correctly, more grounds are better than less grounds. But inherently, you risk that the bonding of each ground is imperfect, and then you have a bunch of grounds at slightly different potentials, and that usually causes more problems than one good ground with a single potential. Yeah, unfortunately, it's not an absolute. People kind of like to think of it in terms of the ground just sucks all the electrons down and gets rid of it, and that's the end of that. There's a lot of things that figure into it. The longer the connector, the more for RF, certainly, it reads as an impedance, which is a resistance to flow, you know, depending upon frequency. So what might be a wonderful ground for direct current might be an awful ground for RF. And that's why a lot of people don't even like to use the term RF ground.
I've read that, so I'm experimenting with all this. You know, and it's all become a major concern for me because I've gotten an amp, which I'll talk about more, I guess, at the next meeting. I'll see what I can come up with. But I guess you're unaware of some resource, you know, that really gets into this, some website or whatever. So let me go on to my second question. And the second question is, what's your opinion on, if you, let's say, are using LMR-400, but you have to splice it with a barrel connector, does that really obviate the LMR-400 in the first place?
In a word, no. Now, you'll get people with differing opinions. That's the beauty of amateur radio. You go on 40 meters, bring up this subject, And if you have five amateurs, you'll get six opinions. There are a few very nice YouTube videos that, if you want, I'll look them up and I'll send you an email of them, where the guy takes, I think it was something like 15 different barrel connectors, puts them end to end, and shows the watt meter reading before he puts them on in line and after he puts them in line. And the amount of watts that he got out, are the loss was negligible.
The impedance, that would seem to be an important factor too.
Impedance is a factor, but it's also related to the length. If your barrel connector, the problem with UHF connectors is they're not impedance matched. N connectors are impedance matched. They're 50 ohms from the one end of the N connector to the other end of the N connector. UHF are about 35 ohms in impedance, generally. There's no specification for that. But it also has to do with the length of the connector. If you had a connector that was 20 feet long, yes, that would put a terrible impact upon your visual. But these things are a couple of inches. So again, in practical terms, if you actually set your amplifier to send out 500 watts and then put a bunch of connectors in a row in line, chances are you're going to read something like 490 watts out. So I understand that you might think that connectors are going to give you a great deal of insertion loss, the more the worse. They do, but to a far lesser extent than a lot of people are worried about.
Can they introduce, on the flip side, on the receiving side, can they introduce noise into the line?
Theoretically, as long as they are well-designed and well-made and there's no corrosion, and so there's no nonlinearity, they shouldn't. The only time that they would introduce distortion is if some component was cold soldered or rusted and it was acting almost like a diode and inserting a nonlinear result into the signal. But a well-operated, a non-corrosive connector should not introduce noise.
Very good, thank you. And here's a very important question. Is our next meeting next Wednesday?
Yes, indeed. As is usual, we are having the meeting on the first Wednesday of the month, and the first Wednesday of April is going to be the 4th. So that's when we will all meet. It will be next Wednesday, and I look forward to it because we missed the last one, and hopefully we'll make up for missed opportunities, and we'll have more things to grouse about.
Thank you, and then I am clear.
Very well, Lloyd, and if a problem or a question pops into your mind, feel free. Let me just ask the general audience, because sometimes people come late and other times people think up a question after the TechNet begins. Anyone out there have a question or a subject or something to say about whatever for the TechNet tonight? Give me your call sign.
We'll go off to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Topic of connectors, I just have a comment. I like BNC connectors, I will admit that. BNC connectors have very similar power handling capabilities as our trusted old UHF connectors, except they are much more dependable on higher frequencies. You will not have the same problems on VHF and UHF as you will have with those so-called UHF connectors. And a part of it is they offer better impedance, and they're more reliable when you connect them. The reason for this is, let me explain briefly. On the UHF connector, not the center conductor, but the outer shell, when you connect it, it provides both the mechanical and electrical connection. Whereas both the BNC and actually the N connector, there is a separate connection for the mechanical connection and for the shield connection between the equipment. So, you know, your impedance does not change, really, depending on how you connect it mechanically, whereas with the UHF connectors, if you don't tighten it fully or, you know, as you change the tightening, actually will change your connection characteristics much more than the other ones. So that's the reason people like the BNC and the end connectors. Now, the end connector is bulky and kind of a little harder to work with and more expensive. And I like the BNC. It's very easy to put on. It's very cheap, actually, and works as a very good replacement for UHF connectors. So that was my short comment. Back to Ned from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Okay, very good. I would suggest that BNCs can have 50 ohm impedance. Unfortunately, they also come in a form that have a 75 ohm impedance. So you have to be careful which BNC that you chose. I'm not quite sure if BNCs have quite the same power handling capacity as the 259. I think that there's a whole bunch of arguments going back and forth of how many watts a BNC connector can consistently take. And I've seen it quoted as low as 250 watts, whereas a PL259 can take thousands of watts. So I'm not quite sure if the power handling capability of BNCs quite match that. It's a very good for quick on, quick off. You don't have to worry about screws getting loose or anything. So it's a very nice design connector in many ways.
I will admit I haven't used it past the amplifier, only before my amplifier, so regarding that. But I think actually it is rated at least for our legal limits, if it's properly built. Now, if you buy the cheap Chinese stuff, I don't really know. I haven't tried with that with high power. Maybe I'll try one day to see what happens, and I'll let you guys know. Kilo Golf to Charlie, back to next.
Okay, very good. That'll be an interesting experiment. Hopefully everything will survive it. I don't know. You know, people argue about all kinds of interesting things, and I remember in the back of my head BNCs being one of the many things that they argued about. And you'll notice that there's pretty much nothing out there that's really designed to take with power that takes a BNC. You see a lot of UHF, a lot of end connectors, but otherwise, that's the two biggies that I see. Have you really seen any device that uses a BNC for a powered output? Usually, it's a very popular one for receiver antenna input.
Yeah, I know, but I think at least as far as specs go, it can take some power. And I know if you looked at the differences between the BNC connectors that are for thinner cable, like I have BNC connectors for RG8X, which is, let's say, medium diameter coax, because it's not like the really thin stuff. And I have BNC connectors for LMR400, and those look like very serious connectors. They don't look like toys like the connectors you get on, for lower power and receive only. So I think if the connector is rated for the right kind of coax, it can handle the power. But it is a more substantial looking connector for the LMR400 that I have. But you're right about the equipment. Back to you.
Okay, so something to think about. But I think people worry way too much about insertion loss of connectors. And like I said, you can find them. They're very easy on YouTube, where people actually do a visual experiment and show you what the meter says. And it's rather intriguing to see how a miss can just kind of be blown apart. So as long as they're not rusty, cruddy old connectors, don't worry too much about having a couple of connectors on your transmission chain. Anyone else with any questions or comments for the technical net tonight?
KE2A with a comment.
Yes, please. Your comment.
Okay. Hey, Roy. I just didn't know if I made it through to the repeater. Just wanted to mention that the video you mentioned with the guy stringing together all the connectors, that's Whiskey 6 Lima Golf. He's got a whole lot of really cool videos some interesting experiences that he talks about in some of his videos, too. And he's got a really cool four-square vertical set up on 20 meters out there in Colorado. Anyway, W6LG, Whiskey 6 Lima Golf, for people looking for that video of the connectors strung together. Back to Net from KE2A.
Thank you very much. He used to run a company. He got sick for a while and kind of put it on hold. You know, if that company ever came back into existence, he had one of those companies that sold power pole connectors and all kinds of little inexpensive gadgets.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm pretty sure he's sort of in another mode in terms of, because I know he had a lot of health issues, so I would doubt it if that company came back, but he is still producing videos, so he's still around. But anyway, back to Net. Thanks, Roy. KE2A.
Yes, well, thank you very much. Yeah, he's very productive. He has a lot of interesting subjects that certainly would be of interest to people getting into the hobby. He has, your first QSO and how different pieces of equipment work, and he's a nice, easy to take guy as well. You know, he's not a little too anxious. He's not monotone. He's probably just the right amount of enthusiasm. So once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Does anyone else have any questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight? Okay, let's go to the TechNet puzzle for March 28, 2018. Which factor below will have the greatest effect on the inductance of a coil with the same number of turns? A is inserting a glass rod inside the coil. B is increasing the current through the coil. C is increasing the diameter of the coil. And D is reducing the diameter of the wire. Anyone want to step up and suggest what the right answer might be? Be shy. Time, if anyone wants to do this, otherwise I'll just do my little recitation on the subject, but does anyone want to suggest what has the greatest effect on the inductance of a coil of wire? Either putting a glass rod through it, increasing the current through it, increasing the diameter of the coil, or reducing the diameter of the wire that the coil is made of.
Net Control, KC2 WTA.
Yes, Joe, you want to volunteer?
Yes, let me see. I'm trying to get that on the page here. I would say changing the diameter of the coil would have the greatest effect. Back to Net Control.
And you are absolutely positively correct. If I had a gold star, I'd send you one. Inserting a glass rod doesn't really do much. If you put a inductance of a coil can be affected by the permeability of its core. So if you put something paramagnetic, like a ferrite material, iron mineral, it would increase the impedance. It would increase the inductance. If you put a diamagnetic material in there, it would somewhat lessen the inductance. A glass rod is kind of a wash. Current has no effect at all on impedance, on inductance. You could double the current and the inductance of a coil remains the same. Reducing the diameter of a wire has a slight effect, but it's much, much less than increasing the diameter of the coil. So the answer for tonight's question was C, increasing the diameter of the coil. Thank you very much, Joe.
Net control, KC2, WTA on the side.
Okay, very good. So, once again, we've gone through the questions, we've gone through the comments, we've gone through the TechNet puzzle. Does anyone have anything else that they need to say tonight before we roll this up and shut it down until the next time? Very well. Before I run the closing credits and such, I have a few little things to say. I know that I'm terribly sad, and I'm sure all the club members who've heard are very sad about the loss of one of our members, Howard Fink, K2IGJ, passed away this Sunday. And we're saddened with the news that Joe, my neighbor, AC2AE's mother, passed away this Monday. All of you in the club has received the notifications and the times and the dates and such, and our hearts go out to them. In addition, I also want to wish everyone a happy and healthy Passover for those who practice Passover, and a great Easter for those who celebrate Easter. TechNet has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, April 4th, sometime around 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m., on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion net on the internet at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, please address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more, guys, and talk a little less. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down now, but we'll be back to do it all over again April 11th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Malen KGDC. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. This is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until the next time, guys. Okay, very good. I guess, it just seemed a little strange, but okay.
Roy Malen, Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee out.
Thank you everyone for the questions, and thank you, Roy, for hosting the net. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie will be clear.